Governor Brown, you don't have the votes to be nominated president. You're not on the list for vice president. What's next for you?
Governor Brown, some of your critics say that you made two major errors in your presidential campaign, not working with the party to get the convention to Los Angeles instead of New York, and then starting your campaign too late.
Governor Brown, is it possible that 4 years from now we'll see you out on the primary hustings challenging an incumbent president, Jimmy Carter?
From CBS News in New York, Capitol Cloakroom on the CBS Radio Network. A spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with an outstanding public figure. This week's guest is Democratic Governor Edmund G. Brown, Jr. of California. He meets with CBS News correspondents George Herman and Sharon Lovejoy and CBS News political analyst Neil Pierce. First, we hear from Mr. Herman.
Governor Brown, we'll just note for the record here that you're 38 years old. You decided at the age of 17 to be a priest, studied at Jesuit institutions for 3.5 years before deciding you were not called to that. You're a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley and of the Yale Law School. A law clerk, a lawyer in private practice, then into elective politics in 1968, Los Angeles Community College Board, California Secretary of State, and now Governor of California. Governor, you're not likely to be nominated successfully as the president tonight. You're not on Jimmy Carter's list to be his vice president. What do you see for yourself as your future? How do you plan to work from here on?
I plan to work as governor of California. There are a number of issues protecting the coastline. There are problems in agriculture, the growing difficulty of the use of pesticides and the growing problem we're having with our crops. The problem of unemployment, housing, all the things that affect America affect California, and I will do my best to do what government can out there, and the things we do affect the country, and what the country does affects us, so I'm going to be very actively involved in all of that.
Do you have any plans to spread yourself out across the country, to keep yourself in the national eye, so to speak?
Well, I don't think I'll confine myself to my office at quite the same level that I did in the past. For the first year and a half, I virtually, I didn't leave California, and I put in 12 hours a day, 6-7 days a week, and I think now it is probably appropriate to venture forth out of the provinces and see what's going on in other parts of the country.
Well, I guess among other things, what I'm trying to find out is, do you plan specifically to keep yourself as a presence in the national political scene so that people will...
Well, I think the governor of California and the governor of New York and other large states are present in the and active in the political process. And my understanding of leadership, certainly from my experience as governor, and I don't think it's all that different for president, is that the person in charge is not in a capsule. The ideas, the pressures, the constituencies, the configuration of forces that surround the president come from many different sources: the Congress, special interest groups, governors, and mayors. And I'm going to be one of those forces.
Do you think that you alienated a lot of party regulars when you refused to work hard to get the convention to Los Angeles, for instance, and then do you think that you started your campaign much too late?
No. Number one, the party regulars outside of California certainly didn't have all that much interest, whether it was here in New York or in California. And I have a feeling the people from California enjoyed the trip. This is a vacation. It's an opportunity to bring their families to the East Coast and to see a different part of the country. So I think that's good. I don't think if you net out the costs that New York makes a lot of money on this. The city lays out a lot of money, and when you add it all up, you'll find out that it's questionable whether or not, when you take in the police overtime and all the rest of it, that there is much profit. So we had a convention in California, and they didn't come to California because of anything I said. They came here because they had it pretty well packaged that this is the place to be. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. This thing was, the convention was pretty well programmed to come to New York City. When I said, why are you saying California doesn't have enough nice hotels? I mean, we're in the McAlpin Hotel, and if this was the criteria for coming to New York instead of California, it isn't a very strong one. Not that I don't mind this, I think it's fine. But because I said delegates could sleep in church basements or in the homes of fellow Democrats, then everyone got all, their feathers began to fly. Well, that's only the beginning. I think the feathers ought to fly in the Democratic Party in a way that they haven't even begun yet.
In what kind of way?
Well, I think we ought to shake this thing up a little bit. There's a little too much complacency. This country's in big trouble. This city's in trouble. And to sit around in a ritual of self-congratulation is not my way of providing decisive leadership. So as we go down the road, I'll add my two cents when I think it's appropriate.
Would you care to tell us a little bit now what we should be doing instead of this ritual of self-congratulation, as you call it?
Well, I think we ought to zero in on, I'd like to know, why is it that the roads around here are so deteriorated that you can barely drive around the city, the place is dirty, the buildings are run down, and you got all these people out of work? It's not a criticism of New York.
This is not California criticizing New York.
No, because it isn't. I don't think it's New York's fault. New York doesn't have the financial base to pay for this. And this is not just New York. It's Newark. It's Rhode Island. It's parts of Oakland, parts of Los Angeles. It's America. Why is it that we have this problem of all these people out of work, young kids that are standing around street corners, and we have old people who are unattended. We have sick people who are in their beds who can't even be, who have sores on their arms because there's no one to turn them over. And yet you have all these people out of work. How do we match the people to the work? And I'm not telling you I've got the precise answer, but at least we shouldn't cover up the problem. And it's profound.
Governor, during the primary season, the political column appeared, which had the heading, "If not Carter, why not Brown?" The idea was that both of you were non-Washington candidates and then essentially the same. Some of us feel there's a major difference. Do you think there's a big difference in the essential approach to government between you and Governor Carter?
Well, I don't know. There may be differences in character and perspective and generation. I have a sense that there's more to this problem than reorganization of the federal government, and I think there's more to the problem of just trust in our institutions. I think Mr. Carter is very right when he says we've got to restore trust, and that's a major problem. But the question is, why is there all this distrust? And I think it's because our philosophy, our premises, and the way we do business is becoming further and further removed from the reality of America as we go down the road to the end of the century. We are an economy heavily dependent on arms sales, on waste and obsolescence, and increasing consumption of things we don't need now, and in a way that puts tremendous pressure on the carrying capacity of our air and our water and our land. And unless we face up to those ecological constraints, then we're in for a very rude awakening. Some people think that the environment is a cosmetic issue, whether the lawn is green or the sky is blue. I consider it a matter of biological survival. And unless we can put our own economy into a more harmonious rhythm with the underlying processes of our atmosphere and our soil and our air and our water, then this great civilization is going to begin to slip back. That's happened to Rome. It happened to the Mediterranean countries. And we have to respect certain absolutes that inhere in the elements, in the resource base. And it isn't just the geniuses. It's not just the technocrats that are poured out of our colleges. There are certain elements to the atmosphere and the environment that have to be reverenced and respected. And my sense is that there is a certain arrogance of knowledge and technology that doesn't give due deference to the respect that is required of those natural materials that are given to us, and if we use them improperly, we're going to be in big trouble.
Since you put it on such a philosophical basis, let me ask you a somewhat abstruse philosophical question that has arisen occasionally in this regard. There are a lot of philosophers who say that this is a natural consequence of the Judaic and Christian religion, that its Bible with God creating the world for man and giving man dominance over it, as opposed to the other world religions, which put man and other parts of the world on a more equal footing, that this Christian and Judaic inheritance is partly responsible for our thinking this way. I ask you as a former seminarian, whether you agree with that.
Well, there are elements. The Christian tradition, and I presume the Judaic tradition, has sufficient diversity that you can find elements of both. Certainly there's a psalm that says that everything was created for man, and that's been true in many ways. But the fact
is... Well, in Genesis, it pretty much says so, doesn't it? We were given dominance over it all.
Also, it says that man will toil, and we've somehow created the false impression that we don't need to toil anymore. We're going to have the machines do that, and we're going to have this unending luxury and consumption. I don't believe that. Herman Kahn has said that we can have 7 billion people on this planet, and they can all have a per capita income of $20,000. I think that is such a fraud and a delusion that if anybody holds that out as where we're going, I think they're headed for destruction.
Well, let me just sort of get back to my original question, which is whether you think the Judaic...
No, I don't think it has to be that. I think there are people within the Judaic tradition, Thomas Merton, Teilhard Chardin, men by the name of Schumacher, who have written about an economics as if people mattered, and a respect for the biological and evolutionary processes. I think it's very significant that Time magazine last week had a cover story on bugs and insects, and indicated in that that in the last 10 years we've increased the war against insects from a annual spending of $250 million to $2.5 billion, and the insects are ahead and they're winning in the destruction of crops and the food and fiber that we produce. So,
let's turn from insects back to politicians.
Yeah, well, I think that's a big issue because our economy depends on our ability to produce food and fiber, keep our balance of payments going. And our agriculture is shifting to a more monoculture, heavy use of fossil fuels, potassium and nitrates. And as the price for that goes up, and as the adverse consequences of leaching the soil and trying to overexploit it becomes apparent, the goose that's laying the golden egg may become less prolific. And that's something we're going to have to deal with in the years ahead.
I got kind of drowned there. Let me just ask you simply if...
I did too. So.
As we tape this on Wednesday morning, is it your plan to be nominated and to have speeches made about you, or are you going to withdraw?
No, I think... why all this talk about nobody should be allowed
I'm
to
I'm not
talk
advocating. I'm really querying.
No, but I find it interesting that to speak... in other than one voice has now become subversive, that this is somehow impertinent. Every journalist I've talked to.
They say,
well, why don't you keep quiet? Why do you persist? Why haven't you joined in the hosannas of praise? I mean, what is this? Is this the Democratic Party? Or have we changed our form of government? Diversity is part of this business. And sure, I'll be nominated.
Well,
if I had a court reporter,
I'd ask him just to read back the question, which is, what are your plans? What do you expect to do?
My plans are that Cesar Chavez and Governor Edwards and Yvonne Brathwaite-Burke will put my name in nomination. They'll speak to some issues, and I'll run a roll call, and Mr. Carter will do quite well.
Will you be there? Will you step foot in the garden?
I don't know. I might. I'm not too. I'm only 2 blocks away. I haven't figured that one out yet.
Governor, since we're talking about your presidential bid, I would like to ask you again, why did you start so late?
Most people ask me why I began so soon. I've only been governor a year, and here I am off running for president. So whether soon or late, I began when I thought it was appropriate. There was a possibility that I could win, but it was a very difficult and remote possibility, but I understood that. I ran because I had something to say. I still think I have something to say. Wherever I went, I did fairly well. I won in California by the largest margin ever recorded in a presidential primary in the history of the United States. I got the largest write-in of any candidate in Oregon. In New Jersey, our delegates won 3-1 over Carter. In Maryland, a border state which I'd never set foot in, didn't know anybody, we won 49-37. And in Rhode Island, the same thing happened.
Why do you think it wasn't enough then?
Wasn't enough because the clock ran out. There were more primaries, and Mr. Carter began earlier. He did a very excellent job.
That brings us back to Sharon's question. Shouldn't you have started earlier?
Well, in some ways, yes, but I'm not sure that one can be off and running for president before he even completes the first year of his governorship. I don't know whether that's meet and proper. So at some point in March, I decided to get in because I didn't think the candidates were really striking a very deep chord in the American people. I didn't find that level of enthusiasm that is very important. And whether that level of enthusiasm has been reached yet, we're going to find out in November.
Governor, I'd like to look to the future with a couple of questions going back to you and Jimmy Carter questions. Isn't your approach quite different from his? He is a sort of a planner. He's a technocrat. He believes that you can really get your society in line with big, comprehensive programs. Your idea seems to be one of pretty high skepticism towards government programs, wondering if government just doesn't intrude too much and try to do too much. Isn't that a fundamental difference between the two of you that would be a pretty ongoing one?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure Mr. Carter would like to think of himself as a big government planner since he's been attacking Washington. I guess maybe my faith in science is not quite as high as his. I have not had the benefit of the scientific education, so I may not understand it as well. But I do think that there are certain processes in nature and in life that man has to not only try to control, but to just accept and respect. And we have a society that has created some degree of illusion in man's ability to manipulate his environment. And sure, we want to try to control things to one extent, but on the other hand, I think we have to accept things the way they are and try to adapt ourselves to things. And a lot of our problems are human. We have an energy department, IRDA, that is our Federal Energy Commission, and they spend billions on this giant technological fix to get new energy sources. When things like windmills and solar heating and creating building toilets that use far less water, small things that can conserve resources, they're not given the emphasis. They're not given the emphasis because they require responsibility on the part of individual human beings to do things for themselves. And that, I think, you cannot save humankind, by gadgets, devices, and plans emanating from some central point. Well, there has to be a culture of individual and collective responsibility. And that's what I don't hear. The utilities and their bond salesmen and their nuclear power plants, a lot of energy could be generated by small windmills in rural and urban areas. I haven't heard anybody talk about that because it's too small. It's not gross. It's not gigantic.
Well, in all fairness, have you seen any economic studies as to how profitable, how they would work out?
I just talked with Henry Royce yesterday. He has a windmill that cost him $5,000 that Buckminster Fuller designed for him, and he says it provides 80% of his energy. It costs 6 cents a kilowatt hour, and in his area in Wisconsin, the utilities are charging 5 cents.
Okay,
and in another 2 years it'll be probably cost saving.
How many years will it cost? I don't know what Henry Royce's farm uses in the way of energy consumption, but how many years will it take to repay the $5,000 cost of installing?
That's what he figures, 6 cents. Kilowatt hour.
No, but how many years of use will it take? In other words, what's the amortization?
How many? I don't know.
But these are the economic studies that people have to make before you really decide whether you're going to put
correct.
These things in.
But I don't think we've given them enough emphasis. Right now, those things, the capital costs
I mean, they all sound
money.
Good, but you really have to run studies on them to see whether they do work out.
Well, you've got a lot of college graduates who like to run studies, and they're looking for jobs now. So
you have the access to them, Governor.
I agree. You're right. You have to measure some of the things that sound good. You got to test them out. But I think there is a bias. There's a bias because utility executives and their brethren in the banking community, when they meet at their restaurants and their Bohemian groves and their other conclaves, they're not talking about windmills and small is beautiful. They're talking about the big scientific fix. They need growth, and they need centralized energy sources. That's what they're used to.
Governor, if we can leave the ecosphere in its broadest sense alone for a moment, you expressed some difference of approach.
Ecotopia is one book that is
really... Some difference of approach with Governor Carter. Now, if he's elected president, do you plan to play the role of loyal supporter? Will you keep quiet for a while? Will you become a sharp critic out of the West, a thorn in his side, where you think on any kind of issue that he's not going along the way you'd like to see him?
Well, I may embark upon a certain period of silence to just reflect on where we all ought to be going.
Well, are you going to watch him with care over a period of
time? I'm going to watch the country with care. No, I want to see the Democratic Party win, and I want Mr. Carter to get the best support he can. He's going to have a tough job if he's elected president, and I think we all have to help him, just like those out in California who are in my party help me. Sometimes it's in a positive way, and sometimes it's in a more critical way, and I think that's good.
Is the difference that you see with him potentially in some areas so great that it's possible that 4 years from now you would be out on the Huskies campaigning against him in the primaries?
I can't envision down the road 4 years. I have to first worry about whether I want to run for re-election.
But it's a possibility. You want to wait and see.
Is it a possibility? I don't like to speculate on possibilities. Anything is possible in life until it is foreclosed. I'm principally focusing on where I am, and I think that we ought to give this man the best chance he has. Because a lot of my view, and this is where my perspective on life and leadership, a lot of things depend on external events. And whoever, it's not one man who's going to save America. It's the American people and forces, many of which we don't understand. So I'd rather confine myself in a positive way to being as supportive as I can, because the principle is not, is it Carter or Brown or Jackson or Udall? It's what's going to happen to the American people. I think that's more important.
That sort of brings us around full circle to where I was at the beginning, and you just, in this last answer, seems to be indicated some uncertainty as to whether you think you will run again for governor. What else interests you besides governorship of California? What might you do if you did not? Just assuming for a moment that you did not run for re-election.
Well, I've been a lawyer. I've been a Jesuit. I've been a law clerk. I've traveled around the world a bit.
But I mean, all these interests in the world that you expressed and in the future of the country, what other avenue might there be besides governorship?
I don't know. I mean, I can't envision myself teaching. I like what I'm doing. I mean, that certainly seems to be my work right now, and to try to, I don't plot out my life in a programmed way that I can tell you what I'm going to do in 10 years. I'm aware of possibilities, and you asked about what's possible in 4 years, and I'm not unaware of possibilities, but I try to take it one day, 1 week at a time, and my focus will be a very intensified concentration on doing the work as governor of the state in which I live.
The impression that sort of emerges from that answer, although you did say a number of things in it, the impression that sort of emerges is that at the moment your interest is in staying on as governor and running for re-election. That's in the future, it sounds like that's what you're interested in.
I'm pretty into what I'm doing, and you know, unless something comes up, I don't imagine I'll change.
What's your next big item? What's your next big policy problem in California that you'll attack?
Well, the coast, we want to protect the coastline in California. That's an important area. And we're working on the Clean Air Amendments. The Congress is now considering drastically weakening the Clean Air Law. Detroit is trying to lobby the Congress into weakening the standards. And I'm going to fight that because I think that people's lungs are as important as Detroit's profits.
Sounds like you've got a fight ahead of you. Thank you very much, Governor Brown, for being with us on Capitol Cloak Room.
You have been listening to the 1,436th meeting in Capitol Cloakroom. This week's guest was Democratic Governor Edmund G. Brown, Jr. of California. He was interviewed by CBS News correspondents George Herman and Sharon Lovejoy and CBS News political analyst Neil Pierce. Be with us next week when our guest will be another prominent personality. Produced by Ellen Wadley, Capitol Cloakroom originated in New York City and is a recorded production of CBS News.